Hello, listeners of The Life of Caesar. My name is Jordan, host of the History News Show, a podcast giving you the most recent news about the past. Every 2 weeks, I cover the latest happenings from the fields of history, prehistory, archaeology, museums, and other things like important anniversaries and commemorations. Go to historynewsshow.com to get all my episodes and find all the ways to subscribe to the podcast. And thank you to the greatest history podcast couple ever, Cam and Ray.
Congratulations, boy.
Many gave their lives that we might stand here once again, united in the government of a lawful republic.
Gaius Octavian was henceforth to be regarded, for all intents and purposes, as my lawful son.
Gaius Octavian Caesar.
Welcome back to The Life of Augustus Caesar, episode 34.
Woo!
How are you, buddy?
Still phenomenal. Still
Don't
is.
Let me play that again. Well, jeez, yeah. This is a big episode and a bit
huge.
Well, I feel, you know, it's whenever we get to these climactic episodes, I kind of feel a little bit sad.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, because it's a major chapter change and nothing will ever be the same again. Yeah, you kill off some people and you start to miss them. You miss them a little bit.
And also, it's just these major characters that are so big and bombastic and confident.
Right. Yeah.
Like Pompey the Great. When he finally died, we were like, shit, it was just, he whimpered away to nothing at the end of his life after
right.
being such a
bitch laugh.
Well, yes, so many victories, even though I know, you know, some of them were sort of on the backs of others, but
still,
he was a major character.
He was the first man in Rome in his time, and you can't get any higher than that. Well, you can,
yeah,
but as far as these people knew, you couldn't get any bigger than that. He was the first man in Rome. He was up there with Gaius Marius, with Sulla, with Caesar, and now he's no more.
Yeah.
And it's about to happen again.
You know, I guess that's one of the reasons why guys like Alexander or Caesar, who kind of die on top, die at the pinnacle
yeah.
of their power.
Pull a James Dean.
Remembered, yeah, so well. The guys like, well, Pompey and, as we're going to see, Mark Antony go out with a whimper, not with a bang.
Right.
So, as we said last time, it's all coming to a head between these guys that have been frenemies for the last 12 or 13 years.
Right. In-laws. You can't get any worse than that.
Octavian and Mark Antony. Finally, gauntlets have been thrown down.
Yes.
Shit is getting real, and it's all going to come to a head.
This is a mano a mano. The other show was a mana a mana.
Womana.
This is yeah. Amana. Yeah, so this is about to come down. And again, I just have to say this real quick before we jump into it. One of them controls half of the Roman Empire and has the potential to control so much more. And that's Mark Antony. And then you've got Caesar over here with Italy and France and, you know, whatever, all that, what's going to be France. It's not enough. They both covet what the other one has. But like you said, I think you're absolutely right. Just the chance that the other one will one day come on your doorstep. You cannot stop growing, whatever it's like a business. You have to keep going. You have to take them out, or one day they will take you out, and you're just going to be left the only one standing. I guess that's just the way the world works.
Coming on your back is one thing, but coming on your doorstep?
Right.
That's crossing the line there,
You come, knock, and run.
You try. That's how it gets all hard and sticky. You can try and clean that up. Oh, it's a nightmare. Hot water won't get it out.
No.
Soap. You'll be down there on your hands and knees with a scrubbing brush for hours.
It's not.
Gets into the fibers of the doormat. Oh.
Yeah. Because when you see the welcome mat, you're thinking, well, I didn't mean it literally. You know, I got to buy a new one.
So on the 2nd of September, 31 BCE,
yeah.
Antony's fleet sailed out of its little hidey hole at Actium to challenge Octavian and Agrippa. And I've thrown some maps up on Facebook, and I'll put them on this blog post. Go and have a look. So if you want to get a better sense of where all of this is taking place. But it's actually down at the bottom of the part of Greece that we've just been talking about in our last episode of Alexander.
It's all happening in the same place.
Epirus, which is where Alexander's mother was from. In the Gulf of Ambracia, which it was just this little gulf like inside Greece, mainland sort of Greece there, bordering Epirus and Acarnania. And it's very hard to get in or out. There's just this little port, which is where Actium is. Antony's had his fleet hidden inside this gulf.
Right.
And he sails out to meet Octavian. But before we cover the battle, we have to go back a bit and explain what's been going on in the last few days, at least. You had some stuff you wanted to cover. Why don't you go first?
Yeah, just that up until this point, and like you said, this is September 2nd, 31 BC. For months, between Agrippa's fleet and Caesar, he's got his troops. You know, he's on the northern promontory, promontory of the bay. They have pretty much got Antony surrounded, and his men have not been able to get fresh supplies. And because there's no tide where they're located at, their wastes, if you will, is not being washed away. So there's a lot of disease, a lot of dysentery. There's a lot of weakened men. He does have a pretty powerful, large army, but over the months when this from when this first started, it has just gone into disrepair. And if they're going to win this at all, it is going to be on the water. It's going to be with his navy, because his men have been told, if we win out there on the sea, you are to march back, you know, to the Pindus Mountains, and then eventually make your way east, because I'm not finished with the Parthians over there. But this is going to be a naval victory or naval defeat, Mark Antony, because his troops have just been suffering for the last couple of months.
Well, actually, I've got some information that kind of runs counter to that.
Then don't say it.
Well, sorry, I'm going to show you up to be ill-prepared as usual. A few days before they sail out, Antony convened his council of war to try and consider their options. They basically had two possible courses of action. One was to pull back by land his entire force into Macedonia. Right. And abandon the fleet. The other was to give battle on the sea.
Right.
Now, he had, or actually there was a third, which was to run away via the sea to try and
I vote for that one. Yeah.
Yeah. But the problem even with running away was he didn't have enough ships to embark all of his men. So even if he could take most of his men on the ships, he'd be leaving behind the bulk of the army to fend for itself, basically. Right. Canidius, who commanded Antony's legions, he was saying that he and Antony should take the land forces back into Macedonia, try and recruit more troops in Greece and around Thrace and the Balkans, while Cleopatra should take her troops and the Egyptian treasury and try and escape the naval blockade and get back to Egypt. And then maybe Antony can meet up with her again there by sort of going into Greece and then coming back round. that was his recommendation. Cleopatra, on the other hand, said no. And now here's a woman giving advice to a Roman consul in a council of war. Where else would that have happened, right?
And you might end up using a word more stronger than advice. But yeah, she certainly put her two cents in, and she's used to be listened to and obeyed. And yeah, and I can't think of another place where she could stand there as their equal and put her two cents in and expect to be listened to.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating. Now, she said that the army was already demoralized. And one of the things that we've sort of skipped over, you briefly mentioned, is in the months leading up to this, there had been a number of land-based skirmishes between Octavian's troops and Antony's troops.
Trying to break the blockade,
Yeah, Agrippa was mostly successful in leading Octavian's troops. There's how they ended up with Antony hemmed in at Actium in the first place. So she said, look, you try and take a demoralized army up through the passes of the Pindus with the enemy at its heels.
Right.
Even if it did reach Macedonia, it's going to be trapped in a Balkan cul-de-sac. Meanwhile, Octavian would have total control of the sea, and he'd be hitting any camps that Antony has piecemeal, breaking them apart. And, you know, you'd obviously destroy Antony's fleet in the process. So she recommended trying to save the fleet and the best part of the army by putting them onto the fleet. They don't have enough ships to get the entire army, but get as many as they can. Maybe the rest of the army they leave behind might be able to make their way into Macedonia and Greece and find the other 11 legions that Antony has scattered around and meet up with them. Worst case scenario, she said, the army they leave behind will defect to Octavian, and then he has to feed and pay them. He's already running out of money. Whilst they have the entire treasury of Egypt, they can keep going for a long, long time. So Canidius on one side, Cleopatra on the other side. Which one do you think Antony's going to throw his lot in with, Ray?
Well, the way I read it, I think he took a little from column A and a little from column B. I think he wanted to fight. I don't think he wanted to go against Cleopatra. I think, and this is just my take on it, I think he was literally like, okay, let's fight. Let's see what happens. Let's see if we can actually win this. If we can, yay for us. If not, we've got Cleopatra's backup plan, because I know my woman. I've had several kids with her. I know she's going to skedaddle, get the hell out of here. But let's see if we can do this first, and if that doesn't work, then let's just try to get out. That's my personal take on what was going through his mind. Obviously, that's only based on what I've read. But you're like, you can't do something, pick something. But I think you just kind of, let's throw it all out there and let's see what happens. That is not how you win a victory. But that's just my take on it.
Well, he certainly didn't march into Macedonia with his troops, so he didn't listen to Canidius.
Right, good point.
So what are you trying to say?
No, just that the whole naval engagement, I don't want to give too much away. It seemed half-assed or whatever. I don't know. But like you said, he doesn't know what he's doing on the seas. If you get him on land, yeah, he's a pretty formidable enemy. But on the seas, he really doesn't know what he's going to do, because he's going to try and fight this naval battle like it's on land. And you cannot do that. Agrippa can tell you that after fighting years against Sextus. It has its own set of rules, and you have to obey those.
I don't think he tries to fight it at all. But anyway, let's get into it.
Hey, real quick before we get into the actual battle, because I just want to jump back on one particular instance, because it's about gratuitous violence, and that's kind of my thing. So there was one point when Caesar was coming down the northern promontory, and that's when Mark Antony realized he was there, and he rushes up from the Peloponnese to the southern promontory. And when he sent men all the way around the Gulf to try and get him behind Caesar, and of course that's not going to work because Caesar's going to send some man of cavalry and push him away. But that's when Mark Antony starts getting paranoid about who he can trust and who he can't. He has one Arab king killed, and then there's supposedly a senator that he didn't trust him. I don't know if he looked at him wrong. He, as far as I could tell in the sources, he literally has this senator tied up to four different horses, and they are ordered to run in four different directions.
He says to the senator, "Do you want to see your quarters?" "Hey, I'm glad you're on. Do you want to see your quarters?" "Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, I'll show you your quarters."
So he's literally mentally, emotionally breaking down. He's losing. It's just looking bad. He's not used to this. He's already got his ass kicked by the Parthians. He had to ask for his wife to help him, or excuse me, his Egyptian wife to help him. And he's just losing. People are leaving him left and right. And did we already talk about Ahenobarbus, how he left him? And Mark Antony felt so bad. He said, "I understand." He sent all his personal belongings to him, but Domitius Ahenobarbus died soon after that because he was sick from whatever was going on. But he's losing people left and right. These people are abandoning him. And so by the time he can actually take it out on someone, he picks this most gruesome of ways to get at this guy who might have done something wrong. He might have just been caught trying to sneak out. But Mark Antony is certainly stressed at this point, and he's not he's not, obviously he's not enjoying himself anymore. His glory days are behind him and he's just trying to hang on as best he can.
Now, I guess I do want to throw in one of our rare and random disclaimers here to say that most of the histories that have survived are sort of pro-Augustus, obviously.
Yeah. So who knows?
Yeah, they're Antony and Cleopatra don't come out well in the surviving histories. And there is a suggestion by modern historians that there's probably a fair amount of anti-Antonian propaganda in the surviving histories. So we don't know how much of this is real and how much is not. And we've said that a million times over the course of this show.
But
and
we'll
the other
keep
shows.
Saying it because it's true. It's absolutely
true. Every now and again, I just want to remind people that we don't know how much of this is accurate, but we're just telling the story as it has come down to us from the ages.
And just one more thing before we jump in. Did we talk about Quintus Delius?
Not yet, but we'll get to him.
Okay. All right. Just checking.
Yeah. Before that, I just wanted to mention that, as we mentioned, I think in the previous episode, when Antony's fleet sails out from the Gulf around Actium, they have their sails on board. And now, this is very unusual when you go into battle because battles are fought with rowers and you don't want to have anything extra on the ship that's going to weigh you down, slow you down. Right. Now, Antony's men were like, what's up with the sails? We were going into battle. And Antony was just all like,
hey, relax, guy. I'm just your average Joe. Take a rest. Hey, relax, guy. Trust me. Hey, relax, guy. I'm going to keep my side of the bargain. Huh?
He said he only had the sails there because he intended to hunt down Octavian's fleet once it had been defeated and make sure none of them survived.
Get him.
And they were like, right.
Now let me add on to that. From what I could tell doing the little bit of research I did, Mark Antony, as far as the number of ships that sail out to meet Agrippa and Caesar, he's got about 250 ships, but Caesar's got about somewhere around 400 ships. So if that's the case, even though Mark Antony had really big ships and ramming them wasn't going to do much good, that's even more preposterous. These guys have got to know you're bullshitting me because they have more ships, but we're supposed to try to hunt down, sail down the survivors and finish them off. That is absolute bullshit. So they are starting to think he doesn't think we can win and he wants to be ready to get the hell out of there. So he's demoralizing his troops even before the battle starts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his plan was basically to get the fuck out of Dodge, but he doesn't want to tell them that because he needs to send them into battle.
Is that where you throw sand in someone's eyes and then run away? I mean, that's the equivalent of what he's doing here.
I don't think, no, that's not what he's... These are his own guys. He's saying, no, listen, really, we're going to fight. You go in there and give your everything. Give your life to me because I'm worth it. Meanwhile, he's that suitcase there? Don't worry about that. I've got all my swords in there because I'm going to be kicking up a storm. Don't you fucking worry about that, son. Meanwhile, as you briefly mentioned before, Octavian learns from one of these last minute defectors, Delius, who goes from Antony over to Octavian, what Antony's plan is. Now, Delius, want to point out, had previously deserted Dolabella for Cassius, then deserted Cassius for Antony, and now he's deserting Antony for Octavian. So this is the kind of guy you want on your team.
Don't tell him any secrets. Now, I looked up something where it said his name, or not his name, maybe his nickname, was something like Horse Changer. Because he kept changing horses in the middle of each run. So, yeah, he goes from Dolabella to Cassius in 43, Cassius to Mark Antony in 42, and then, of course, to Caesar in 31. So this guy is all over the place. And he was also supposedly the guy who procured lovers for Mark Antony, which made, obviously, that Cleopatra hated him a lot. So when he does come over, he tells Caesar that she wanted to kill me because I was just doing my job being a big Roman pimp. But it worked for him because he made it over to the winning side. So no principles or morals, but he's still around, breathing. Not bad.
Yeah, look, and he'd been a very close, intimate friend of Antony's for 10 years. He was the guy that Antony sent to Alexandria 10 years earlier in 41 BCE summon Cleopatra to appear before him in Tarsus to answer for the money she'd supposedly sent to Cassius during the war against Antony and Octavian. Then in 40 or 39 BCE, Antony sent Dellius to Judea to help Herod the Great fight the last of the Hasmoneans, Antigonus. So he's been a very important part of Antony's entourage. He went with Antony to Parthia. He was the guy who was sent to persuade the Armenian king Artavasdes to wed his four-year-old daughter to Antony's six-year-old son, which was the setup, to capture him. So very, very close guy, and now he's fucked Antony over because he can see the writing on the wall.
But here's the brilliant part. So because of Dellius, Caesar, who was going to be on the right-hand side, Agrippa, who's going to be on the left-hand side of their navy, they know what Mark Antony is going to be is planning. But even though they know the plan, you think they would win hands down. But Cleopatra, again, who's got her own plan. So even though they know it's coming, they in some ways don't know it's coming. And she's going to be able to show them once again why she's been able to stay alive and in power for so long.
No, I think they do know what's coming. I think
there's one little tiny, I didn't want to give it away, but I think there's one little tiny thing they didn't think through is my point. But no, they definitely know what she's going to try.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, they know that she and Antony are going to try and escape. And Octavian's plan is to let them and then chase after them and hunt them down. Agrippa convinces him not to do that, but to give battle because he's worried they'll be too slow to catch them because Antony's fleet has sails. They had discarded their own sails to make way for action. So he says, no, let's just go head to head and take care of it right now. He's also confident of victory. So for the next few days, storms really prevent anything from happening. But then on the 2nd of September, the skies are clear. Mm-hmm. Before they give battle, according to Dio, they each man gives a last rallying speech.
Of course.
Do you have any of these you want to read out?
No, I was just going to say that early on, and then I'll let you read the speech. They can see a lot of smoke coming from Mark Antony's side. And what he's doing is, like you said earlier, he is burning the smaller ships that they don't have enough rowers for. Again, this happened, I think, to the Greeks in the Alexander episode. You always got to have enough rowers. So he's going to burn these ships because he doesn't want Caesar getting a hold of them and use them. So he's going to burn his extra ships. He's going to come out fighting. But again, so this, because of their burning the ships, Caesar and Agrippa know that it is about to happen. It is about to go down. He's about to come out because he's cutting his losses. And that's what you do before you launch your attack.
Mm-hmm. So they give speeches.
Speech away.
This is a small part of Antony's speech that I liked. I hesitate on general principles to add anything personal concerning myself by way of boasting. Yet since this too is one of the factors which contribute to victory in war, and in the opinion of all men is of supreme importance, I mean that men who are to wage war successfully must also have an excellent general. Necessity itself has rendered quite inevitable what I shall say about myself in order that you may realize even better than you do this truth, that you yourselves are the kind of soldiers that could win even without a good leader, and that I am the kind of leader that could prevail even with poor soldiers. Somebody said, well, what happened in Parthia? He goes, shut the fuck up, have that man killed. For I am at that age when men are at their very prime,
ooh,
both in body and in mind, kind of like Ray and Cam, and are hampered neither by the rashness of youth nor by the slackness of old age, but are their strongest because they occupy the mean between these two extremes.
Nice.
Moreover, I have the advantage of such natural gifts and of such a training that I can, with the greatest ease, make the right decision in every case and give it utterance. As regards experience, which, as you know, causes even the ignorant and the uneducated to appear to be of some value, I have been acquiring that through my whole political and my whole military career. For from boyhood down to the present moment, I have continually trained myself in these matters. I have been ruled much and have ruled much, and thereby I have learned, on the one hand, all the tasks of whatever kind the leader must impose, and on the other, all the duties of whatever kind the subordinate must obediently perform. I have known fear. I have known confidence. Therefore, I have schooled myself through the one not to be afraid of anything too readily, and through the other not to venture on any hazard too heedlessly. I have known good fortune. I have known failure. Consequently, I am able to avoid both despair and excess of pride. I speak to you who know what I say is true, and make you who hear it my witnesses to its truth, not with the intention of uttering idle boasts about myself. Enough for me, so far as fame is concerned, is your consciousness of it. But to the end that you may, in this way, bring home to yourselves how much better we are equipped than our opponents. For while they are inferior to us, not only in number of troops and in abundance of money, but also in diversity of equipment, yet in no one respect are they so lacking as in the youth and inexperience of their commander. About his deficiencies in general, I do not need to speak precisely of in detail, but I will sum up the whole matter and say, what you also know, that he is a veritable weakling in body, and has never by himself been victor in any important battle, either on the land or on the sea. Indeed, at Philippi, in one and the same conflict, it was I that conquered and he that was defeated. So great is the difference between us two. But as a rule, it is those who have the better equipment that secure the victories. Now, if our opponents have any strength at all, you will find it to exist in their heavy armed force and on land. As for their ships, they'll not even be able to sail out against us at all. For you yourselves, of course, see the length and beam of our vessels, which are such that even if the enemies were a match for them in number, yet because of these advantages on our side, they could do no damage, either by charging bows on or by ramming our sides. For in the one case, the thickness of our timbers, and in the other, the very height of our ships would certainly check them, even if there were no one on board to ward them off. Where indeed will anyone find a chance to assail ships which carry so many archers and slingers, who have the further advantage of striking their assailants from the towers aloft? But if anyone should manage to come up close, how could he fail to get sunk by the very number of our oars? Or how could he fail to be sent to the bottom when shot at by all the warriors on our decks and in our towers? Do not imagine now that they possess any particular seamanship just because Agrippa won a naval battle off Sicily. For they contend not against Sextus, but against his slaves. Not against a like equipment with ours, but against one far inferior. If anyone is inclined to make much of their good fortune in that combat, he is bound to reckon on the other side the defeat which Caesar himself suffered at the hands of Sextus himself. In this way, he'll find not merely that our chances are equal, but that all the considerations on our side are far more numerous and far better than on theirs. In a word, how large a part does Sicily form of the whole empire? How large a fraction of our force did the troops of Sextus possess that anyone should reasonably fear engagement with the infantry? Anyone should reasonably fear Caesar's armament, which is precisely the same as before and has grown neither larger nor better merely because of his good luck rather than take courage because of his defeat. It is precisely in view of these considerations, therefore, that I have not cared to risk a first engagement with the infantry where they appear to have strength in a way, in order that no one of you should become disheartened as a result of a reverse in that arm. Instead, I have chosen to begin with the ships, where we are strongest and have a vast superiority over our antagonists, in order that a victory with these we may scorn their infantry also. For you know well that the turn of the scale in this war depends on both sides entirely upon just this. I mean, our fleets. For if we come out victorious with this arm, we shall thenceforth suffer no harm from any of their other forces either, but shall cut them off on an islet, as it were, since all the regions round about are in our possession, and shall subdue them without trouble, if in no other way, at least by hunger.
Nice. Early
what do you
on,
think of that speech, man?
Early on in the speech when he was bragging about himself, I thought one of his men were going to stand up and go, do you mean your name is Caesar? Because he's right over there. But anyway, yeah, he was stroking it pretty hard early on in that speech. But you gotta rouse the men. You got to give them their, you know, Band of Brothers speech to try and get them to fight really hard for you, so then you can go back and live in the lap of luxury and screw your Egyptian queen. So good for him.
I don't want to boast and brag, but...
I'm a god.
You're a god.
I'm a god. I'm not the god.
I don't want to brag, Ray, but I'm fucking awesome. I just want to... Look, awesome. We can't escape the fact. I'm fucking awesome. Accept that.
Go with it. Go
red.
With it.
Yeah.
In fact, yeah. Chant that as you're battling. My leader is awesome. Yeah. So like you said, so it's not until the afternoon they're burning the ships and everybody's getting ready, and they when the ships come out, it's going to take them hours to get into their proper positions. Mark Antony's ships are going to come out, and he's going to have two rows of ships facing the enemy, and actually there's a third row behind him, but those ships look differently. They have purple sails. Those are Cleopatra's ships, but because they're hanging back, even though they're the third line, it looks as if they are not going to participate in the coming battle.
Yeah, before you get into that,
yeah.
I've got more speeches.
Oh, I'm sorry.
More talking about the ships.
Speech away.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So Dio also has a speech from Octavian. Now, again, very, very long. I'm just going to read a couple of paragraphs. Octavian started by reminding his troops of all the peoples the Romans have conquered throughout the ages. Then he continues, "Would not all those who have performed the exploits I have named grieve mightily if they should learn that we had succumbed to an accursed woman? Should we not be acting most disgracefully if, after surpassing all men everywhere in valor, we should then meekly bear the insults of this throng who, oh heavens, are Alexandrians and Egyptians? What worse or what truer name could one apply to them? Who worship reptiles and beasts as gods, who embalm their own bodies to give them the semblance of immortality, who are most reckless in effrontery, but most feeble in courage, and who, worst of all, are slaves to a woman and not to a man, and yet have dared to lay claim to our possessions and to use us to help them acquire them, expecting that we will voluntarily give up to them the prosperity which we possess. Who would not lament at seeing Roman soldiers acting as bodyguards of this queen? Who would not groan at hearing that Roman knights and senators fawn upon her like eunuchs? Who would not weep when he hears and sees Antony himself, the man twice consul, often imperator, to whom was committed in common with me the management of the public business, who is entrusted with so many cities, so many legions, when he sees that this man has now abandoned all his ancestors' habits of life, has emulated all alien and barbaric customs, that he pays no honor to us or to the laws or to his father's gods, but pays homage to that wench as if she was some Isis or Selena, calling her children Helios and Selena, and finally taking for himself the title of Osiris or Dionysus, and after all this, making presents of whole islands or parts of the continents as though he were the master of the whole earth and the whole sea. All these things seem marvellous and incredible to you soldiers, as I am well aware, but you ought therefore to be the more indignant. For if that is actually true, which you do not believe even when you hear it, and if that man in his luxurious indulgence does commit acts at which anyone would grieve who learns of them, would it not be reasonable that you should go past all bounds in your rage? Yet I myself was so devoted to him at the beginning that I gave him a share in our command. He gave him, mind you. Mm-hmm. I gave it to him.
Aww.
Married my sister to him, granted him legions. After that, I felt so kindly, so affectionately towards him that I was unwilling to wage war on him merely because he had insulted my sister, or because he neglected the children that she had borne him, or because he preferred the Egyptian woman to her, or because he bestowed upon that woman's children practically all your possessions, or for any other cause. My reason was, first of all, that I did not think it proper to assume the same attitude toward Antony as toward Cleopatra, for I had judged her, if only on account of her foreign birth, to be an enemy by reason of her very conduct. But I believe that he, as a citizen, might still be brought to reason. Later, I entertained the hope that he might, if not voluntarily, at least reluctantly, change his course as a result of the decrees passed against her. Consequently, I did not declare war upon him at all. He, however, has looked haughtily and disdainfully upon my efforts and will neither be pardoned, though we would fain pardon him, nor me pitied, though we try to pity him. He is either heedless or mad. For indeed I have heard and believed that he has been bewitched by that accursed woman, and therefore pays no heed to our generosity or kindness. But being a slave to that woman, he undertakes the war and its self-chosen dangers on her behalf against us and against his country. In view of all this, what is left to us but the duty of fighting him together with Cleopatra and repelling him? Therefore, let no one count him a Roman, but rather an Egyptian, nor call him Antony, but rather Serapion. Let no one think he was ever consul or imperator, but only gymnasiarch. For he has himself, of his own free will, chosen the latter names instead of the former, and casting aside all the august titles in his own land, has become one of the cymbal players from Canopus. Again, let no one fear him on the ground that he will turn the scale of war. For even in the past he was of no account, as you who conquered him at Mutina know clearly enough.
He wasn't even at Mutina, that was his brother.
Shh, details, details.
Don't worry about that.
But even if he did at one time attain to some valour through campaigning with us, be well assured that he has now spoiled it utterly by his changed manner of life. For it is impossible for one who leads a life of royal luxury and coddles himself like a woman to have a manly thought or do a manly deed, since it is an inevitable law that a man assimilates himself to the practices of his daily life.
Mm. So the
and scene.
Yeah, and scene. So the first seven rows who heard that speech were really pissed and really ready to go. The other 1,300 rows who did not hear the speech said, "What do you say? I don't know, but I'm just going to pay it. So let's go fight." Yeah! Historical fact.
Yeah. Thanks. That's great.
No, when you've got a couple thousand men there, or you're on your ships and your ships are scattered out 4 miles, you give your speech, but not everybody can hear it. So
yeah,
whatever. Not that I'm trying to be buzzkill. I totally am not.
Mm-hmm.
And I apologize if I came across that way.
Mm-hmm. So before we get into the battle, I want to talk about ships.
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 In the night. Ships in the night. Uh-huh.
So Antony's entire fleet apparently numbered 500, but 230 of those were these massive war galleys that he mentioned in his speech that I read above.
And he was right to be very proud of them. They were very tall, very high up, and it was very hard to get on them, as we're going to see when the battle starts. So he was certainly correct in being confident that, yeah, they're going to have a hell of a time just getting aboard our ship, even if it didn't have anybody defending it. So he certainly, it certainly is right in that estimate of those 230 ships.
Yeah, so the majority of them were Octaris, which were 8 bank rowing galleys.
Damn.
8 banks of rowers on either side with huge rams on the front.
Mm-hmm.
They could weigh over 250 tons.
Oh my God.
His personal flagship, though, like those of his admirals, was a Decares that had 10 bank rowing galleys. I posted an artist's impression of one of these on Facebook the other day. These things looked fucking incredible.
And just picture hundreds of them scattered throughout. That's got to be a hell of a sight.
Well, I don't think he had hundreds. Most of them were Octaris.
Oh, right. No, I meant
the Decares were him and his admirals, yeah.
Right.
The Decares and I think also the Octaris both had a tower on either end, like a siege tower.
Right.
You could get on top and fire down on the ships that were coming close to you. The Decares, though, I wanted to point out, was first used by a little guy called Alexander the Great. And was last used by Mark Antony at the Battle of Actium. Talk about full fucking circle, my friend.
Bookends.
They were the largest ship ever used in ancient naval warfare. Wow. Now, larger ships were built. There were ships built up with, I think, up to like 40 bank rowing galleys.
My God.
By pharaohs and, you know, the Pompeian times, etc. But they weren't used in actual battles. This was the largest ever used. The bows of these ships were armed with bronze plates and square-cut timbers to make a ramming attack difficult.
Right. Smart.
And, so he leads these straits, these ships out through the straits towards the open sea. As you say, he was struggling with rowers, so he probably had less than the total amount actually actively engaged. Now, he sails out. Octavian's fleet is waiting for him out there. As we mentioned earlier, thanks to the defection of Delius, the horse changer, they kind of knew what the battle plan was. And it wasn't just to escape. It was also to try and get Octavian to attack first.
Right. To mess up his lines. Yeah. Because they're bottled up pretty good in that gulf. So anyway, so they don't fight, obviously, first thing in the morning. So they come out. And like you said, they want Mark Antony and Caesar to... they want Agrippa and Caesar to come at them. Because if they come at them, it's going to mess up their very well-formed line that took them hours to set up. So they're both just sitting there facing off each other. Mark Antony sees it. They're not going to come and get him. So he is going to send his left wing, which is facing Caesar, out towards them to start the attack.
Yeah, so I just wanted to do the lineup of the fleets too. Now, Agrippa has the overall command of Octavian's fleet. Octavian's not stupid.
Right.
The command of the right wing of Octavian's fleet is given to Marcus Lurius, who was the prefect of Sardinia and had been expelled by Minas, the Minas slave, on the orders of Sextus back in 40.
Right.
The center, so their ships are aligned in three lines, like one line actually, but three divisions,
parts,
I guess.
Yeah.
Three parts, yeah. The center is given to Lucius Aruntius. He himself had sought refuge with Sextus after being proscribed back in 43. So imagine that. He's been prescribed, now he's fighting with one of the guys who prescribed him.
Not bad.
Octavian is behind the right wing aboard a Liburnian, which is a smaller version of a trireme. It has two banks of oars, like a bireme, but it's faster and lighter than your typical bireme or trireme. He has a number of these ships that are used as like courier ships, getting orders to different parts of the fleet, and he's on one himself. And also on the land, he's got our mate Titus Statilius Taurus,
Nice.
The
name.
Bull, we remember him from back earlier on when they were fighting Sextus. He's commanding Octavian's armies, but they're sitting on the north of the straits, just sitting and watching, basically, right, as this all goes on.
Yeah.
Antony's fleet is also divided into three squadrons, about 60 ships apiece, with another 60 in reserve under Cleopatra, who's behind the center. He's got the best of his fighting men on board the ships.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily going to be terribly useful in a lot of this until the ships get up close and they can shoot archers and everything down on the opponents. Most of these battles are fought by ramming and grappling and that kind of stuff, but you do want to have guys with... They've got catapults and they've got archers to try and attack and also defend your ship if it's getting attacked.
Right.
But he's also got, I read, most of his non-combatants on board.
Hmm.
Not because they're going to contribute anything, but to prevent them from running away or creating a mutiny.
Interesting.
Yeah, and maybe just to throw them at the ships, I don't know. You can use them as a human shield, a flesh shield.
I like that.
Antony and a guy called Publicola command the right wing of Antony's fleet, while Marcus Octavius, who had fought with Pompey against Caesar, and Marcus Instius command the center. Now, this guy who fought with Pompey against Caesar, he's managed to survive a long time. He's one of the very few that's still around.
Nice. I wonder if he's a horse changer as well.
And then Gaius Sosius, who was the consul recently, and he's one of the two consuls that fucked off, which sort of started this whole thing, went to Antony. He is in charge of the left wing of the fleet, while Antony's chief lieutenant, Publius Canidius Crassus, who I mentioned earlier, he's in command of Antony's land forces. Again, they're just sitting at Actium watching all this go down.
Yeah.
Octavian has 8 legions and 5 praetorian cohorts, approximately 40,000 men on his ships.
Nice.
And Antony has about 20,000 men dispersed over all of his vessels. So Antony has about 90, Octavian has about 90 combat effectives per ship.
Mm-hmm.
Antony has 110 to 120 per
ship. So yeah, this can turn into a land battle where the ships come up and you latch them together and your men go on the other one. Yeah, so he's certainly got an advantage there.
No, he doesn't.
No,
Octavian has more ships.
Right. I see what you're saying. Yeah,
more men as far as, and
if
more
ship
ships.
On ship. Ship on ship action. But
yeah,
as we know, it's not going to turn out the way. Tell you what, let me go back to what I was reading, because it turned out it was the correct part. It's the 6th hour of the day, not the 6th hour of the battle. So I apologize for that. So Plutarch writes, "But it was now the 6th hour, and since a wind was rising from the sea, the soldiers of Antony became impatient at the delay, and relying on the height and size of their own ships as making them unassailable, they put their left wing in motion. When Caesar saw this, he was delighted and ordered his right wing to row backwards, wishing to draw the enemy still further out from the gulf and the narrows, and then to surround them with his own agile vessels and come to close quarters with ships which, owing to their great size and the smallness of the crews, were slow and ineffective." So like what you were saying earlier, bring them out, try and use the more numerous ships that you have to surround them and have several ships attack each one of Mark Antony's ships. So again, bring them out and start attacking them. So the battle has been started. Mark Antony and his men are getting impatient, and Mark Antony launches his left wing of his navy.
Yeah, I still think you're jumping ahead, because you have to explain why the wind picking up is important.
Right. Well, okay, yeah, because what I read was, as the day went on in this area of the world, as the day went on, the wind naturally would grow stronger, I think north by northwest, I'm trying to remember, and that is going to be a particular advantage to whoever has sails on their ships. And as we already covered, there's two groups of people that have got sails. Mark Antony's battleships, his warships, they've been carrying their sails, are ready to go, but the other person who's got sails on her ships was Cleopatra, who's behind watching all of this.
Yeah, that's the key thing to I think appreciate is when the trumpet signal rang out for the start of the battle and Antony's fleet starts sailing out, Agrippa pulls back out into deeper water. He doesn't want to get engaged too close to the land.
Right.
And Antony just sits there waiting for him. So for most of the day, up until the middle of the day,
staring contest.
They're just all sitting there looking out. This is hot, man. Yeah. We're talking September. It's kind of, you know, like end, just after the end of summer.
Yeah.
It's going to be hot. You're sitting out in the water from 9 o'clock in the morning to midday. But Antony is waiting for the afternoon because both sides knew that at this time of the year, the winds were calm until the middle of the day, which is when they pick up and they hit a peak around 3 p.m.
Right.
Now, that is an important in a battle of rowers, except maybe for the choppiness or the calmness of the water and that kind of stuff. But if you are trying to escape by using sails,
right,
pretty important that you wait until the winds pick up. Trying to escape using your sails when there's no wind, you're not going to get very far. Everyone stand up and blow really, really hard.
Oh, that reminds me of Vegas. But what they what both sides know is that just south of the right wing of Caesar and the left wing of Mark Antony, there's a little island called Lucas. And they both know that if the Marcus Antonius' ships can get past that island, they will be in the winds. They can put up their sails and make pretty good speed down from there on out. So even though they're backing up a little bit, they got to make sure that Marcus Antonius and Cleopatra ships do not get past the Lucas. I think it's pronounced Lucas. I don't know. L-E-U-C-A-S or K-A-S. They have to make sure that as much as they come out, do not let them get past that island, or they will be able to make a run for it. And because they have sails, if they can get going, it will be very hard to catch them.
Yeah, so Agrippa and Octavian obviously know what Antony's plan is because of the defector, so they just keep pulling further and further it out, keeping an eye on that wing.
Right.
And Antony, in order to take advantage of the wind, starts moving further and further away from the shore himself because the wind is obviously going to be strongest out in the middle of the sea.
Mm-hmm.
And when he starts to do that, Octavian or Agrippa order his vessels to steer around and try and circumvallate,
nice,
or trap, surround Antony's fleet because they've got the greater number of ships.
Circumvallate aquatically.
Yes.
Yes, there we go.
Now, Antony sees what's going on. He's obviously doesn't want to get surrounded. And this is when finally he gives the word to attack.
Yeah. So now there's going to be a general engagement. Agrippa on the left is going to try to swing around, but the guy behind Mark Antony, what is his name, Publicola, is going to go out and try to meet him. So as the two ends are starting to spread out to make sure no one can get around anyone else, the center of both lines is going to start to thin out and start to weaken. And this is the part where the ships actually come together. They start fighting each other. And Plutarch writes, "The fighting took on much of the character of a land battle, or to be more exact, of an attack of a fortified town. Three or four of Octavian's ships clustered around each one of Antony's, and the fighting was carried on with wicker shields, spears, poles, and flaming missiles, while Antony's soldiers also shot with catapults from wooden towers." So now that they're really starting to get engaged, it is kind of like a land battle. They're certainly treating it that way, but because Mark Antony's ships are so tall, they're having a very hard time with them, and two or three or four of Agrippa's ships have to get in close and try to abort them or to attack them with his men, but they've got the number of ships to do it, so that part of the plan seems to be working out. But the key thing is the center of both lines is starting to get thinner, and it's starting to get weaker.
Okay. Before we get too far ahead, I just want to talk about the different kinds of ships and the battle tactics. I think this is our last big chance to really talk about that, mm-hmm, on this series.
Since it's the last naval battle.
Yeah. So the Octares war galley I mentioned before, which is the majority of Antony's fleet, has about 200 heavy marines and archers on it, and about 6 ballista catapults. That's what it could hold. I mean, he's probably got less. I think he's probably, as I said, 110, 120. But six ballista catapults it could hold. And they're much, much taller than Octavian's ships. Remember, these are 8 galleys, and most of Octavian's ships, as we'll see in a minute, are only 5.
Right.
So if one of Octavian's ships gets up close to one of Antony's, Antony's ships are able to rain down missiles from the ballistas and the archers on top of it. Mm. They're almost impossible to sink by ramming, which we saw in the old sexy pea battles is the major battle tactic here. The only way to disable a ship this big was really to smash its oars,
right,
rendering it immovable, and then you could surround it and just attack it from all sides and try and overwhelm it with boarding attacks. Now, Octavian's fleet was largely made up of the standard Roman warship, the Quinquereme, 5 bank rowing galleys, and he had some smaller quadremes, which were 4 bank rowing galleys mixed in. So smaller ships, but his crews are better trained, professional, well-fed, rested, mm-hmm, as opposed to Antony's that are, we mentioned, suffering from malaria, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. So lighter ships, better trained, but his ships are also more maneuverable. And as you mentioned, reading from Plutarch, the Agrippa tactic was to fight like a cavalry battle, get in close, attack the above-deck crew with arrows and missiles launched from ballistas on your own ship, and then quickly run away before they could attack back.
Right.
The ballista, a medium-sized ballista, was also capable of penetrating the sides of most warships if you got it in at close range. They had a range of about 200 yards, so you could try and do that, but most ballista shots were aimed at the marines on the decks to try and take them out. You think about it, you take out the crew on the deck,
right,
and then if you can take out enough of them, then you can get close and actually take out the hull of the ship itself.
Right.
There are terms for these battle tactics. Dikeplos and anastrophe.
Mm.
You heard about those?
No.
Did you read those?
No.
Dikeplos. So this is what it was called in the old battle tactic books. Because these come from ancient Greece, all of these tactics. Dikeplos was the way that you infiltrated an enemy's line of battle. You would basically get all of your ships in a line abreast and try and row through the gaps of your enemy's line.
Mm-hmm.
You would get all of your ships to target like a weak spot. And once you'd successfully sailed through that weak spot, you would turn around, which is anastrophe, means turning around, and attack the susceptible side of their vessel.
Ah.
Because they would tend to have their ballistas pointed in one direction, which is the direction that the enemy is faced. It's very hard to quickly turn a ballista around. Yeah. Anastrophe, by the way, is also what you call it when somebody talks like this.
For 800 years have I trained Jedi. I don't counter where I keep on who is to be trained.
I did not know that.
Jedi must have the deepest commitment, the most serious mind. This one, a long time have I watched. All his life as he looked away to the future, to the horizon, never his mind on where he was, what he was doing. Adventure, excitement. Jedi craves not these things.
Yeah, I play that to myself every day. It's my alarm clock that wakes me up in the morning.
No, now
adventure, excitement. A podcaster craves not these things.
I know we have to stop soon, but we have to cover this. We have to discuss and break it down. Yoda's split personality. When Luke Skywalker first went to the planet that he was on, I can't remember what it was called, Dagobah, I can't remember what the fuck, whatever it's called. He was a jokey little
system.
He was a jokey little thing, making, you know, stealing his food, whatever, just, you know, and then he got serious later on. But so I almost had a hard time taking Yoda seriously, because when he first came onto the screen, when he first was approached, he was this comical, this humorous, this almost scapegoat creature. And then they made him much more serious in the center of everything. He's like the Christ-like figure or whatever. But anyway, that just kind of rubbed me wrong for a while, and I just wanted to share that with you. Thoughts?
No, that's classic Joseph Campbell, you know, the hero with a thousand faces, when the hero's journey, when the hero meets his true master, but the true master, you know, is hidden.
Yes.
The guru that you meet on the road is hidden, is in disguise. You don't know that it's the god or the hero or the witch that's going to bring you to your calling. That's classic mythological archetypes there, my friend.
He's testing you. The testing has begun to see how you react to that. And yeah, because Luke, because you know what, he threw his food away. Luke could have taken out his blaster and shot at him. He's like, no, don't do that. You know, so it was a test. It was
wouldn't have mattered. It's a Jedi, man.
Well, yeah, but he didn't know that. He didn't. He could have just been a dick about it. Man, you're throwing my food. I'm stuck on this planet. Pew, pew, pew. Whatever. But no, he was nice to the weird green thing. That's I just wanted to say that.
Well, I think that's where we have to end this episode, Ray. I think we've done an hour.
Yes. Yes, we have. So everybody's got their tactics. Everybody's got their plan. Battle has been joined. Now we just have to see how it ends.
I'm going to read a review before we wrap up from the United Kingdom.
Oh, okay.
Bar Morris, titled his or her, I think his or her, I don't know, fuck anymore. if you like
this is Top our two Gear people.
And history, this is the podcast for you. Now, I'm going to start this by saying I've never watched Top Gear because I don't give a fuck about cars.
Is that what he said? If you like Top Gear and podcasts, okay. Top Gear is about cars, right?
This is what he says.
Okay.
Cameron Riley is the Australian left-wing Jeremy Clarkson. He's funny, opinionated, and interesting. I think that's supposed to mean he is.
Yeah.
He wrote his typo. Yeah. Together with Ray Harris, not as funny as Cam, but gets Cam to shine like Richard Hammond, the Top Gear hamster, just American.
Ouch.
Yeah, you're a hamster.
I'm an American hamster.
Yeah. Ray and Cam give Roman history events a funny twist, and that makes you think, what would you do if you were any one of the people of that period? Harris gives the story a personal touch and sympathy for the winners and losers. Cam tells story the details while adding his jokes, which make you listen with a smile. I think Bar Morris was shit-faced.
Yes, he had a roach clip in one hand and typing with the other.
I started with Life of Caesar and listened to a podcast 18, which was a mistake as I did not get many of the inner jokes. Yeah, so start from the begging. Every chapter, Ray and Cam improve the storytelling and the jokes become wilder and funnier, and funnier includes a lot of fun and funny profanity, which adds to the fun. Cam also adds in a lot of references to current history and other periods, which is a great bonus.
Yeah.
It's just fun to listen to. Don't miss it. If you love history or just a good story, then it's a must-listen-to podcast. Well, thank you, Bar Morris. Hard to read that, but thank you for taking the effort.
Thank you for the effort, yes.
I hope you sobered up okay after you wrote that.
Yes.
Send us an email, rva@lifeofcaesar.com, with your address, and we will send you a thank you note, present, gift, thing.
Something.
Yeah. That's it, folks. That is today's show. We'll be back next week.
We really
with another
will.
Episode Promise. Of Augustus.
Life of Augustus. That's all I had.
There can be only one. I am the great Cornholio.
My bladder wasn't ready for that. I said a hip, hop, the hip, the hip, they did a
hip, give a hop, but you don't stop the. Woo! And we're out.